The bookstall keeper got into the coach, and away they drove. Chapter 12, in which Oliver is taken better care of than he ever was before, with some particulars concerning a certain picture. The coach rattled away over nearly the same ground as that which Oliver had traversed when he first entered London in company with the Dodger, and turning a different way when it reached the Angel at Islington, stopped at length before a neat house in a quiet shady street near Pentonville. Here a bed was prepared without loss of time, in which Mr. Brownlow saw his young charge carefully and comfortably deposited, and here he was tended with a kindness and solicitude that knew no bounds. But for many days Oliver remained insensible to all the goodness of his new friends. The sun rose and sank, and rose and sank again, and many times after that. And still the boy lay stretched on his uneasy bed, dwindling away beneath the dry and wasting heat of fever. The worm does not his work more surely on the dead body than does this slow creeping fire upon the living frame. Weak and thin and pallid, he awoke at last from what seemed to have been a long and troubled dream. Feebly raising himself in the bed, with his head resting on his trembling arm, he looked anxiously around. "What room is this? Where have I been brought to?" said Oliver. "This is not the place I went to sleep in." He uttered these words in a feeble voice, being very faint and weak, but they were overheard at once. The curtain at the bed's head was hastily drawn back, and a motherly old lady, very neatly and precisely dressed, rose as she undrew it from an armchair close by in which she had been sitting at needlework. "Hush, my dear," said the old lady softly. "You must be very quiet, or you will be ill again. And you have been very bad as bad could be, pretty nigh. Lie down again, there's a dear." With those words, the old lady very gently placed Oliver's head upon the pillow, and smoothing back his hair from his forehead, looked so kindly and lovingly in his face that he could not help placing his little withered hand in hers, and drawing it round his neck. "Save us," said the old lady, with tears in her eyes. "What a grateful little dear it is! Pretty creature! What would his mother feel if she had sat by him as I have, and could see him now?" "Perhaps she does see me," whispered Oliver, folding his hands together. "Perhaps she has sat by me. I almost feel as if she had." "Well, that was the fever, my dear," said the old lady mildly. "I suppose it was," replied Oliver, "because heaven is a long way off, and they are too happy there to come down to the bedside of a poor boy. But if she knew I was ill, she must have pitied me even there, for she was very ill herself before she died. She can't know anything about me, though," added Oliver, after a moment's silence. "If she had seen me hurt, it would have made her sorrowful, and her face has always looked sweet and happy when I have dreamed of her." The old lady made no reply to this, but wiping her eyes first and her spectacles, which lay on the counterpane afterwards, as if they were part and parcel of those features, brought some cool stuff for Oliver to drink, and then, patting him on the cheek, told him he must lie very quiet or he would be ill again. So Oliver kept very still, partly because he was anxious to obey the kind old lady in all things, and partly, to tell the truth, because he was completely exhausted with what he had already said. He soon fell into a gentle doze, from which he was awakened by the light of a candle, which, being brought near the bed, showed him a gentleman with a very large and loud-ticking gold watch in his hand, who felt his pulse, and said he was a great deal better.
"You are a great deal better, are you not, my dear?" said the gentleman.
"Yes, thank you, sir," replied Oliver.
"Yes, I know you are," said the gentleman. "You're hungry too, aren't you?"
"No, sir,"
answered Oliver. "Ahem," said the gentleman. No, I know you're not. He's not hungry, Mrs. Bedwin, said the gentleman, looking very wise. The old lady made a respectful inclination of the head, which seemed to say that she thought the doctor was a very clever man. The doctor appeared much of the same opinion himself.
You feel sleepy, don't you, my dear? Said the doctor.
No, sir, replied Oliver.
No, said the doctor, with a very shrewd and satisfied look. You're not sleepy. Nor thirsty, are you?
Yes, sir, rather thirsty, answered Oliver.
Just as I expected, Mrs. Bedwin, said the doctor. It's very natural he should be thirsty, perfectly natural. You may give him a little tea, ma'am, and some dry toast without any butter. Don't keep him too warm, ma'am, but be careful that you don't let him be too cold. Will you have the goodness?
The old lady dropped a curtsy. The doctor, after tasting the cool stuff and expressing a qualified approval of it, hurried away, his boots creaking in a very important and wealthy manner as he went downstairs. Oliver dozed off again soon after this. When he awoke, it was nearly 12 o'clock. The old lady tenderly bade him good night shortly afterwards, and left him in charge of a fat old woman who had just come, bringing with her, in a little bundle, a small prayer book and a large nightcap. Putting the latter on her head and the former on the table, the old woman, after telling Oliver that she had come to sit up with him, drew her chair close to the fire and went off into a series of short naps, checkered at frequent intervals with sundry tumblings forward and divers moans and chokings. These, however, had no worse effect than causing her to rub her nose very hard and then fall asleep again. And thus the night crept slowly on. Oliver lay awake for some time, counting the little circles of light which the reflection of the rushlight shade threw upon the ceiling, or tracing with his languid eyes the intricate pattern of the paper on the wall. The darkness and the deep stillness of the room were very solemn. As they brought into the boy's mind the thought that death had been hovering there for many days and nights, and might yet fill it with the gloom and dread of his awful presence, he turned his face upon the pillow and fervently prayed to heaven. Gradually, he fell into that deep, tranquil sleep which ease from recent suffering alone imparts, that calm and peaceful rest which it is pain to wake from. Who, if this were death, would be roused again to all the struggles and turmoils of life, to all its cares for the present, its anxieties for the future, more than all, its weary recollections of the past? It had been bright day for hours when Oliver opened his eyes. He felt cheerful and happy. The crisis of the disease was safely past. He belonged to the world again. In 3 days' time, he was able to sit in an easy chair, well propped up with pillows. And as he was still too weak to walk, Mrs. Bedwin had him carried downstairs into the little housekeeper's room, which belonged to her. Having him set here by the fireside, the good old lady sat herself down too, and being in a state of considerable delight at seeing him so much better, forthwith began to cry most violently. "Never mind me, my dear," said the old lady. "I'm only having a regular good cry. There, it's all over now, and I'm quite comfortable."
"You're very, very kind to me, ma'am," said Oliver.
"Well, never you mind that, my dear," said the old lady. "That's got nothing to do with your broth, and it's full time you had it, for the doctor says Mr. Brownlow may come in to see you this morning, and we must get up our best looks, because the better we look, the more he'll be pleased."
And with this, the old lady applied herself to warming up in a little saucepan a basin full of broth, strong enough, Oliver thought, to furnish an ample dinner when reduced to the regulation strength for 350 paupers at the lowest computation.
"Are you fond of pictures, dear?" inquired the old lady, seeing that Oliver had fixed his eyes most intently on a portrait which hung against the wall just opposite his chair.
"I don't quite know, mum," said Oliver,
without taking his eyes from the canvas.
"I have seen so few that I hardly know. What a beautiful, mild face that lady's is."
"Ah," said the old lady,
Painters always make ladies out prettier than they are, or they wouldn't get any custom, child. The man that invented the machine for taking likenesses might have known that would never succeed. It's a deal too honest. A deal, said the old lady, laughing very heartily at her own acuteness. Is that a likeness, Mum? Said Oliver. Yes, said the old lady, looking up for a moment from the broth. That's a portrait. Whose, Mum? Asked Oliver. Why, really, my dear, I don't know, answered the old lady in a good-humoured manner. It's not a likeness of anybody that you or I know, I expect. It seems to strike your fancy, dear. It is so very pretty, replied Oliver. Why, sure you're not afraid of it, said the old lady, observing in great surprise the look of awe with which the child regarded the painting. Oh, no, no, returned Oliver quickly. But the eyes look so sorrowful, and where I sit, they seem fixed upon me. It makes my heart beat, added Oliver in a low voice, as if it was alive, and wanted to speak to me, but couldn't. Lord save us, exclaimed the old lady, starting. Don't talk in that way, child. You're weak and nervous after your illness. Let me wheel your chair round to the other side, and then you won't see it. There, said the old lady, suiting the action to the word. You don't see it now, at all events. Oliver did see it in his mind's eye, as distinctly as if he had not altered his position. But he thought it better not to worry the kind old lady. So he smiled gently when she looked at him. And Mrs. Bedwin, satisfied that he felt more comfortable, salted and broke bits of toasted bread into the broth, with all the bustle befitting so solemn a preparation. Oliver got through it with extraordinary expedition, and had scarcely swallowed the last spoonful, when there came a soft rap at the door. "Come in," said the old lady, and in walked Mr. Brownlow. Now the old gentleman came in as brisk as need be, but he had no sooner raised his spectacles on his forehead and thrust his hands behind the skirts of his dressing-gown to take a good long look at Oliver than his countenance underwent a very great variety of odd contortions. Oliver looked very worn and shadowy from sickness, and made an ineffectual attempt to stand up out of respect to his benefactor, which terminated in his sinking back into the chair again. And the fact is, if the truth must be told, that Mr. Brownlow's heart, being large enough for any six ordinary old gentlemen of humane disposition, forced a supply of tears into his eyes by some hydraulic process which we are not sufficiently philosophical to be in a condition to explain. "Poor boy, poor boy," said Mr. Brownlow, clearing his throat. I'm rather hoarse this morning, Mrs. Bedwin. I'm afraid I have caught cold."
"Oh, I hope not, sir," said Mrs. Bedwin. "Everything you have had has been well aired, sir."
I don't know, Bedwin. I don't know," said Mr. Brownlow. "I rather think I had a damp napkin at dinner time yesterday, but never mind that. How do you feel, my dear?"
"Very happy, sir," replied Oliver, "and very grateful indeed, sir, for your goodness to me."
"Good boy," said Mr. Brownlow stoutly. "Have you given him any nourishment, Bedwin? Any slops, eh?"
"He has just had a basin of beautiful strong broth, sir," replied Mrs. Bedwin, drawing herself up slightly and laying a strong emphasis on the last word, to intimate that between slops and broth well compounded there existed no affinity or connection whatsoever.
"Oh," said Mr. Brownlow with a slight shudder, "a couple of glasses of port wine would have done him a great deal more good, wouldn't they? Tom White, eh?"
"My name is Oliver, sir," replied the little invalid with a look of great astonishment.
"Oliver?" said Mr. Brownlow. "Oliver what? Oliver White, eh?"
"No, sir. Twist.
Oliver Twist." "Queer name," said the old gentleman. "What made you tell the magistrate your name was White?"
"I never told him so, sir," returned Oliver in amazement. This sounded so like a falsehood that the old gentleman looked somewhat sternly in Oliver's face.
It was impossible to doubt him. There was truth in every one of its thin and sharpened lineaments.
"Some mistake," said Mr. Brownlow.
But although his motive for looking steadily at Oliver no longer existed, the old idea of the resemblance between his features and some familiar face came upon him so strongly that he could not withdraw his gaze.
"I hope you are not angry with me, sir,"
said Oliver, raising his eyes beseechingly.
"No, no," replied the old gentleman.
"Gracious God, what's this? Bedwin, look. Look there." As he spoke, he pointed hastily to the picture above Oliver's head, and then to the boy's face. There was its living copy. The eyes, the head, the mouth, every feature was the same. The expression was, for the instant, so precisely alike that the minutest line seemed copied with an accuracy which was perfectly unearthly. Oliver knew not the cause of this sudden exclamation, for he was not strong enough to bear the start it gave him, and he fainted away. Chapter 13 reverts to the merry old gentleman and his youthful friends, through whom a new acquaintance is introduced to the intelligent reader, and connected with whom various pleasant matters are related appertaining to this history. When the Dodger and his accomplished friend, Master Bates, joined in the hue and cry which was raised at Oliver's heels, in consequence of their executing an illegal conveyance of Mr. Brownlow's personal property, as has been already described with great perspicuity in a foregoing chapter, they were actuated, as we therein took occasion to observe, by a very laudable and becoming regard for themselves, and forasmuch as the freedom of the subject and the liberty of the individual are among the first and proudest boasts of a true-hearted Englishman, so, I need hardly beg the reader to observe, that this action should tend to exalt them in the opinion of all public and patriotic men in almost as great a degree as this strong proof of their anxiety for their own preservation and safety goes to corroborate and confirm the little code of laws which certain profound and sound-judging philosophers have laid down as the mainsprings of all nature's deeds and actions, the said philosophers very wisely reducing the good lady's proceedings to matters of maxim and theory, and, by a very neat and pretty compliment to her exalted wisdom and understanding, putting entirely out of sight any considerations of heart or generous impulse and feeling. For these are matters totally beneath a female who is acknowledged by universal admission to be far above the numerous little foibles and weaknesses of her sex. If I wanted any further proof of the strictly philosophical nature of the conduct of these young gentlemen in their very delicate predicament, I should at once find it in the fact, also recorded in a foregoing part of this narrative, of their quitting the pursuit when the general attention was fixed upon Oliver, and making immediately for their home by the shortest possible cut. Although I do not mean to assert that it is usually the practice of renowned and learned sages to shorten the road to any great conclusion, their course indeed being rather to lengthen the distance by various circumlocutions and discursive staggerings, like unto those in which drunken men under the pressure of a too mighty flow of ideas are prone to indulge, still I do mean to say, and do say distinctly, that it is the invariable practice of many mighty philosophers, in carrying out their theories, to evince great wisdom and foresight in providing against every possible contingency which can be supposed at all likely to affect themselves. Thus, to do a great right, you may do a little wrong, and you may take any means which the end to be attained will justify. The amount of the right, or the amount of the wrong, or indeed the distinction between the two, being left entirely to the philosopher concerned, to be settled and determined by his clear, comprehensive, and impartial view of his own particular case. It was not until the two boys had scoured with great rapidity through a most intricate maze of narrow streets and courts that they ventured to halt beneath a low and dark archway. Having remained silent here just long enough to recover breath to speak, Master Bates uttered an exclamation of amusement and delight, and bursting into an uncontrollable fit of laughter, flung himself upon a doorstep and rolled thereon in a transport of mirth. "What's the matter?"
inquired the Dodger. Roared Charlie Bates.
Hold your noise, remonstrated the Dodger, looking cautiously round. Do you want to be grabbed, stupid? I can't help it, said Charlie. I can't help it. To see him splitting away at that pace and cutting round the corners and knocking up against the posts and starting on again as if he was made of iron as well as them, and me with the wipe in my pocket singing out after him, oh, my eye.
The vivid imagination of Master Bates presented the scene before him in two strong colours. As he arrived at this apostrophe, he again rolled upon the doorstep and laughed louder than before.
"What'll Fakin say?" inquired the Dodger,
taking advantage of the next interval of breathlessness on the part of his friend to propound the question.
"What?" repeated Charlie Bates. "Ah, what?" said the Dodger. "Why, what should he say?" inquired Charlie, stopping rather suddenly in his merriment, for the Dodger's manner was impressive. "What should he say?"
Mr. Dawkins whistled for a couple of minutes, then, taking off his hat, scratched his head and nodded thrice.
"What do you mean?" said Charlie. "Tooralolloo, gammon and spinach, the froggy wouldn't and high cockalorum," said the Dodger, with a slight sneer on his intellectual countenance.
This was explanatory, but not satisfactory. Master Bates felt it so, and again said, "What do you mean?" The Dodger made no reply, but putting his hat on again and gathering the skirts of his long-tailed coat under his arm, thrust his tongue into his cheek, slapped the bridge of his nose some half-dozen times in a familiar but expressive manner, and turning on his heel, slunk down the court. Master Bates followed with a thoughtful countenance. The noise of footsteps on the creaking stairs, a few minutes after the occurrence of this conversation, roused the merry old gentleman as he sat over the fire with a saveloy and a small loaf in his left hand, a pocket knife in his right, and a pewter pot on the trivet. There was a rascally smile on his white face as he turned round and, looking sharply out from under his thick red eyebrows, bent his ear towards the door and listened.
"Why, how's this?" muttered the Jew, changing countenance. "Only two of them. Where's the third? They can't have got into trouble. Hark!"
The footsteps approached nearer. They reached the landing. The door was slowly opened, and the Dodger and Charlie Bates entered, closing it behind them.
"Where's Oliver, you young hounds?" said the furious Jew, rising with a menacing look. "Where's the boy?"
The young thieves eyed their preceptor as if they were alarmed at his violence and looked uneasily at each other. But they made no reply.
"What's become of the boy?" said the Jew, seizing the Dodger tightly by the collar and threatening him with horrid imprecations. "Speak out, damn you, or I'll throttle you!"
Mr. Fagin looked so very much in earnest that Charlie Bates, who deemed it prudent in all cases to be on the safe side, and who conceived it by no means improbable that it might be his turn to be throttled second, dropped upon his knees and raised a loud, well-sustained and continuous roar, something between a mad bull and a speaking trumpet.
"Will you speak?"
thundered the Jew, shaking the Dodger so much that his keeping in the big coat at all seemed perfectly miraculous.
"Why, the traps have got him, and that's all about it," said the Dodger sullenly. "Come, let go of me, will you?"
And swinging himself at one jerk clean out of the big coat, which he left in the Jew's hands, the Dodger snatched up the toasting fork and made a pass at the merry old gentleman's waistcoat, which, if it had taken effect, would have let a little more merriment out than could have been easily replaced. The Jew stepped back in this emergency with more agility than could have been anticipated in a man of his apparent decrepitude, and, seizing up the pot, prepared to hurl it at his assailant's head. But Charlie Bates, at this moment calling his attention by a perfectly terrific howl, he suddenly altered its destination and flung it fully at that young gentleman.
"Why, what the blazes is in the wind now?" growled a deep voice. "Who pitched that ear at me? It's well it's the beer and not the pot as hit me, or I'd have settled somebody. I might have knowed as nobody but an infernal, rich, plundering, thundering old Jew could afford to throw away any drink but water, and not that unless he'd done the river company every quarter. What's it all about, Fagin? Damn me if my neck handkerchief ain't lined with beer. Come in, you sneaking warmint. What are you stopping outside for, as if you was ashamed of your master? Come in."
The man who growled out these words was a stoutly built fellow of about 35, in a black velveteen coat, very soiled drab breeches, lace-up half-boots, and grey cotton stockings, which enclosed a bulky pair of legs with large swelling calves, the kind of legs which, in such costume, always look in an unfinished and incomplete state without a set of fetters to garnish them. He had a brown hat on his head and a dirty belcher handkerchief round his neck, with the long frayed ends of which he smeared the beer from his face as he spoke. He disclosed, when he had done so, a broad, heavy countenance with a beard of 3 days' growth and two scowling eyes, one of which displayed various parti-coloured symptoms of having been recently damaged by a blow.
"Come in, d'ye hear?"
growled this engaging ruffian. A white, shaggy dog, with his face scratched and torn in 20 different places, skulked into the room.
"Why didn't you come in afore?" said the man. "You're getting too proud to own me afore company, are you? Lie down."
This command was accompanied with a kick, which sent the animal to the other end of the room. He appeared well used to it, however, for he coiled himself up in a corner very quietly, without uttering a sound, and, winking his very ill-looking eyes about 20 times in a minute, appeared to occupy himself in taking a survey of the apartment.
"What are you up to? Ill-treating the boys, you covetous, avaricious, insatiable old fence," said the man, seating himself deliberately. "I wonder they don't murder you. I would, if I was them. If I'd been your apprentice, I'd have done it long ago. And no, I couldn't have sold you afterwards, for you're fit for nothing but keeping as a curiosity of ugliness in a glass bottle. And I suppose they don't blow glass bottles large enough."
"Hush, hush, Mr. Sykes," said the Jew, trembling. "Don't speak so loud."
"None of your mistering," replied the ruffian. "You always mean mischief when you come that. You know my name. Out with it. I shan't disgrace it when the time comes."
Well then, Bill Sykes," said the Jew with abject humility. "You seem out of humour, Bill."
"Perhaps I am," replied Sykes. "I should think you was rather out of sorts too, unless you mean as little harm when you throw pewter pots about as you do when you blab and—"
"Are you mad?"
said the Jew, catching the man by the sleeve and pointing towards the boys. Mr. Sykes contented himself with tying an imaginary knot under his left ear and jerking his head over on the right shoulder, a piece of dumb show which the Jew appeared to understand perfectly. He then, in cant terms, with which his whole conversation was plentifully besprinkled, but which would be quite unintelligible if they were recorded here, demanded a glass of liquor.
"And mind you don't poison it,"
said Mr. Sykes, laying his hat upon the table. This was said in jest, but if the speaker could have seen the evil leer with which the Jew bit his pale lip as he turned round to the cupboard, he might have thought the caution not wholly unnecessary, or the wish, at all events, to improve upon the distiller's ingenuity, not very far from the old gentleman's merry heart. After swallowing 2 or 3 glasses of spirits, Mr. Sykes condescended to take some notice of the young gentleman, which gracious act led to a conversation in which the cause and manner of Oliver's capture was circumstantially detailed, with such alterations and improvements on the truth as to the Dodger appeared most advisable under the circumstances.
"I'm afraid," said the Jew, "that he may say something which will get us into trouble."
"That's very likely," returned Sykes with a malicious grin. "You're blowed upon, Fagin."
"And I'm afraid, you see,"
added the Jew, speaking as if he had not noticed the interruption, and regarding the other closely as he did so,
"I'm afraid that if the game was up with us, it might be up with a good many more, and that it would come out rather worse for you than it would for me, my dear."
The man started and turned fiercely round upon the Jew, but the old gentleman's shoulders were shrugged up to his ears, and his eyes were vacantly staring on the opposite wall. There was a long pause. Every member of the respectable coterie appeared plunged in his own reflections, not excepting the dog, who by a certain malicious licking of his lips seemed to be meditating an attack upon the legs of the first gentleman or lady he might encounter in the streets. when he went out. "Somebody must find out what's been done at the office," said Mr. Sykes, in a much lower tone than he had taken since he came in. The Jew nodded assent. "If he hasn't peached and is committed, there's no fear till he comes out again," said Mr. Sykes. "And then he must be taken care on. You must get hold of him somehow." Again the Jew nodded. The prudence of this line of action indeed was obvious, but unfortunately there was one very strong objection to its being adopted. This was that the Dodger and Charlie Bates and Fagin and Mr. William Sykes happened one and all to entertain a violent and deeply rooted antipathy to going near a police office on any ground or pretext whatever. How long they might have sat and looked at each other, in a state of uncertainty not the most pleasant of its kind, it is difficult to guess. It is not necessary to make any guesses on the subject, however, for the sudden entrance of the two young ladies whom Oliver had seen on a former occasion caused the conversation to flow afresh.
"The very thing," said the Jew. "Bet will go, won't you, my dear?"
"Where's?" inquired the young lady.
"Only just up to the office, my dear," said the Jew coaxingly.
It is due to the young lady to say that she did not positively affirm that she would not, but that she merely expressed an emphatic and earnest desire to be blessed if she would. A polite and delicate evasion of the request, which shows the young lady to have been possessed of that natural good breeding which cannot bear to inflict upon a fellow creature the pain of a direct and pointed refusal. The Jew's countenance fell, and he turned to the other young lady, who was gaily, not to say gorgeously, attired in a red gown, green boots, and yellow curl papers.
"Nancy, my dear," said the Jew in a soothing manner, "what do you say?"
"That it won't do, so it's no use of trying it on, Fagin," replied Nancy.
"What do you mean by that?" said Mr. Sykes, looking up in a surly manner.
"What I say, Bill," replied the lady collectedly.
"Why, you're just the very person for it," reasoned Mr. Sykes. "Nobody about here knows anything of you."
"And I don't want 'em to, neither," replied Nancy in the same composed manner. "It's rather more no than yes with me, Bill."
"She'll go, Fagin," said Sykes.
"No, she won't, Fagin," bawled Nancy.
"Yes, she will, Fagin," said Sykes.
And Mr. Sykes was right. By dint of alternate threats, promises and bribes, the engaging female in question was ultimately prevailed upon to undertake the commission. She was not, indeed, withheld by the same considerations as her agreeable friend, for having recently removed into the neighbourhood of Field Lane from the remote but genteel suburb of Ratcliffe, she was not under the same apprehension of being recognised by any of her numerous acquaintances. Accordingly, with a clean white apron tied over her gown and her curl papers tucked up under a straw bonnet, both articles of dress being provided from the Jew's inexhaustible stock, Miss Nancy prepared to issue forth on her errand.
"Stop a minute, my dear," said the Jew, producing a little covered basket. "Carry that in one hand. It looks more respectable, my dear."
"Give her a door key to carry in her t'other one, Fagin," said Sykes. "It looks real and genuine-like."
Yes, my dear, so it does," said the Jew, hanging a large street door key on the forefinger of the young lady's right hand. "There, very good indeed, my dear," said the Jew, rubbing his hands.
"Oh, my brother, my poor dear, sweet, innocent little brother," exclaimed Miss Nancy, bursting into tears and wringing the little basket and the street door key in an agony of distress. "What has become of him? Where have they taken him to? Oh, do have pity and tell me what's been done with the dear boy, gentlemen. Do, gentlemen, if you please, gentlemen."
Having uttered these words in a most lamentable and heartbroken tone, to the immeasurable delight of her hearers, Miss Nancy paused, winked to the company, nodded smilingly round, and disappeared.
"Ah, she's a clever girl, my dears," said the Jew,
turning round to his young friends and shaking his head gravely, as if in mute admonition to them to follow the bright example they had just beheld.
"She's a honour to her sex,"
said Mr. Sykes, filling his glass and smiting the table with his enormous fist.
"Here's her health, and wishing they was all like her."
While these and many other encomiums were being passed on the accomplished Miss Nancy, that young lady made the best of her way to the police office, whither, notwithstanding a little natural timidity, consequent upon walking through the streets alone and unprotected, she arrived in perfect safety shortly afterwards. Entering by the back way, she tapped softly with the key at one of the cell doors and listened. There was no sound within, so she coughed and listened again. Still there was no reply, so she spoke.
"Nolly, dear," murmured Nancy in a gentle voice. "Nolly."
There was nobody inside but a miserable, shoeless criminal who had been taken up for playing the flute, and who, the offence against society having been clearly proved, had been very properly committed by Mr. Fang to the House of Correction for 1 month, with the appropriate and amusing remark that since he had so much breath to spare, it would be more wholesomely expended on the treadmill than in a musical instrument. He made no answer, being occupied in mentally bewailing the loss of the flute, which had been confiscated for the use of the county. So Nancy passed on to the next cell and knocked there.
"Well," cried a faint and feeble voice. "Is there a little boy here?" inquired Nancy with a preliminary sob.
"No," replied the voice. "God forbid."
This was a vagrant of 65 who was going to prison for not playing the flute, or, in other words, for begging in the streets and doing nothing for his livelihood. In the next cell was another man who was going to the same prison for hawking tin saucepans without a licence, thereby doing something for his living, in defiance of the stamp office. But as neither of these criminals answered to the name of Oliver or knew anything about him, Nancy made straight up to the bluff officer in the striped waistcoat, and, with the most piteous wailings and lamentations, rendered more piteous by a prompt and efficient use of the street door key and the little basket, demanded her own dear brother. "I haven't got him, my dear," said the old man.
"Where is he?" screamed Miss Nancy, in a distracted manner. "Why, the gentleman's got him," replied the officer. "What gentleman? Oh, gracious heavens, what gentleman?" exclaimed Miss Nancy.
In reply to this incoherent question, the old man informed the deeply affected sister that Oliver had been taken ill in the office and discharged in consequence of a witness having proved the robbery to have been committed by another boy, not in custody, and that the prosecutor had carried him away in an insensible condition to his own residence, of and concerning which all the informant knew was that it was somewhere at Pentonville, he having heard that word mentioned in the directions to the coachman. In a dreadful state of doubt and uncertainty, the agonized young woman staggered to the gate, and then, exchanging her faltering walk for a swift run, returned by the most devious and complicated route she could think of to the domicile of the Jew. Mr. Bill Sykes no sooner heard the account of the expedition delivered than he very hastily called up the white dog, and, putting on his hat, expeditiously departed, without devoting any time to the formality of wishing the company good morning.
"We must know where he is, my dears. He must be found," said the Jew, greatly excited. "Charlie, do nothing but skulk about till you bring home some news of him. Nancy, my dear, I must have him found. I trust to you, my dear, to you and the Artful for everything. Stay, stay," added the Jew, unlocking a drawer with a shaking hand. "There's money, my dears. I shall shut up this shop tonight. You'll know where to find me. Don't stop here a minute. Not an instant, my dears."
With these words, he pushed them from the room, and carefully double-locking and barring the door behind them, drew from its place of concealment the box which he had unintentionally disclosed to Oliver, and hastily proceeded to dispose the watches and jewellery beneath his clothing. A rap at the door startled him in this occupation.
"Who's there?"
he cried in a shrill tone.
"Me,"
replied the voice of the Dodger through the keyhole.
"What now?"
cried the Jew impatiently.
"Is he to be kidnapped to the other ken, Nancy says?"
inquired the Dodger.
"Yes," replied the Jew, "wherever she lays hands on him. Find him, find him out, that's all. I shall know what to do next, never fear."
The boy murmured a reply of intelligence and hurried downstairs after his companions.
"'He has not peached so far,' said the Jew, as he pursued his occupation. "'If he means to blab us among his new friends, we may stop his windpipe yet.'"
End of side 3. Side 4, Chapter 14, comprising further particulars of Oliver's stay at Mr. Brownlow's, with the remarkable prediction which one Mr. Grimwig uttered concerning him when he went out on an errand. Oliver soon recovered from the fainting fit into which Mr. Brownlow's abrupt exclamation had thrown him, and the subject of the picture was carefully avoided both by the old gentleman and Mrs. Bedwin in the conversation that ensued, which indeed bore no reference to Oliver's history or prospects, but was confined to such topics as might amuse without exciting him. He was still too weak to get up to breakfast, but when he came down into the housekeeper's room next day, his first act was to cast an eager glance at the wall, in the hope of again looking on the face of the beautiful lady. His expectations were disappointed, however, for the picture had been removed.
"Ah," said the housekeeper, watching the direction of Oliver's eyes, "it is gone, you see."
"I see it is, mum," replied Oliver, with a sigh. "Why have they taken it away?"
"It has been taken down, child, because Mr. Brownlow said that as it seemed to worry you, perhaps it might prevent your getting well, you know," rejoined the old lady.
"Oh, no, indeed. It didn't worry me, mum," said Oliver. "I liked to see it. I quite loved it."
"Well, well," said the old lady, good-humouredly, "you get well as fast as ever you can, dear, and it shall be hung up again. There, I promise you that. Now, let us talk about something else."
This was all the information Oliver could obtain about the picture at that time. As the old lady had been so kind to him in his illness, he endeavoured to think no more of the subject just then. So he listened attentively to a great many stories she told him about an amiable and handsome daughter of hers who was married to an amiable and handsome man and lived in the country, and about a son who was clerk to a merchant in the West Indies and who was also such a good young man and wrote such dutiful letters home 4 times a year that it brought the tears into her eyes to talk about them. When the old lady had expatiated a long time on the excellences of her children and the merits of her kind, good husband, besides, who had been dead and gone, poor dear soul, just 26 years, it was time to have tea. After tea, she began to teach Oliver cribbage, which he learned as quickly as she could teach, and at which game they played with great interest and gravity, until it was time for the invalid to have some warm wine and water with a slice of dry toast, and then to go cosily to bed. They were happy days, those of Oliver's recovery. Everything was so quiet and neat and orderly. Everybody was kind and gentle, that after the noise and turbulence in the midst of which he had always lived, it seemed like heaven itself. He was no sooner strong enough to put his clothes on properly than Mr. Brownlow caused a complete new suit and a new cap and a new pair of shoes to be provided for him. As Oliver was told that he might do what he liked with the old clothes, he gave them to a servant who had been very kind to him, and asked her to sell them to a Jew and keep the money for herself. This she very readily did. And as Oliver looked out of the parlour window and saw the Jew roll them up in his bag and walk away, he felt quite delighted to think that they were safely gone, and that there was now no possible danger of his ever being able to wear them again. They were sad rags, to tell the truth, and Oliver had never had a new suit before. One evening, about a week after the affair of the picture, as he was sitting talking to Mrs. Bedwin, there came a message down from Mr. Brownlow that if Oliver Twist felt pretty well, he should like to see him in his study and talk to him a little while.
"Bless us and save us! Wash your hands, and let me part your hair nicely for you, child," said Mrs. Bedwin. "Dear heart alive, if we had known he would have asked for you, we would have put you a clean collar on and made you as smart as sixpence."
Oliver did as the old lady bade him, and although she lamented grievously meanwhile that there was not even time to crimp the little frill that bordered his shirt collar, he looked so delicate and handsome, despite that important personal advantage, that she went so far as to say, looking at him with great complacency from head to foot, that she really didn't think it would have been possible on the longest notice to have made much difference in him for the better. Thus encouraged, Oliver tapped at the study door. On Mr. Brownlow calling to him to come in, he found himself in a little back room quite full of books, with a window looking into some pleasant little gardens. There was a table drawn up before the window, at which Mr. Brownlow was seated reading. When he saw Oliver, he pushed the book away from him and told him to come near the table and sit down. Oliver complied, marvelling where the people could be found to read such a great number of books as seemed to be written to make the world wiser, which is still a marvel to more experienced people than Oliver Twist, every day of their lives.
"There are a good many books, are there not, my boy?"
said Mr. Brownlow, observing the curiosity with which Oliver surveyed the shelves that reached from the floor to the ceiling.
"A great number, sir," replied Oliver. "I never saw so many."
"You shall read them, if you behave well," said the old gentleman kindly, "and you will like that better than looking at the outsides. That is, in some cases, because there are books of which the backs and covers are by far the best parts."
"I suppose they are those heavy ones, sir," said Oliver, pointing to some large quartos with a good deal of gilding about the binding.
"Not always those," said the gentleman, patting Oliver on the head and smiling as he did so. "There are other equally heavy ones, though of a much smaller size. How should you like to grow up a clever man and write books, eh?"
"I think I would rather read them, sir," replied Oliver.
"What? Wouldn't you like to be a book writer?" said the old gentleman.
Oliver considered a little while, and at last said he should think it would be a much better thing to be a bookseller, upon which the old gentleman laughed heartily and declared he had said a very good thing, which Oliver felt glad to have done, though he by no means knew what it was.
"Well, well," said the old gentleman, composing his features. "Don't be afraid. We won't make an author of you while there's an honest trade to be learnt, or brick-making to turn to."
"Thank you, sir,"
said Oliver. At the earnest manner of his reply, the old gentleman laughed again, and said something about a curious instinct, which Oliver, not understanding, paid no very great attention to. "Now," said Mr. Brownlow, speaking, if possible, in a kinder, but at the same time in a much more serious manner than Oliver had ever known him assume yet.
"I want you to pay great attention, my boy, to what I'm going to say. I shall talk to you without any reserve, because I am sure you are as well able to understand me as many older persons would be."
"Oh, don't tell me you're going to send me away, sir, pray,"
exclaimed Oliver, alarmed at the serious tone of the old gentleman's commencement.
"Don't turn me out of doors to wander in the streets again. Let me stay here and be a servant. Don't send me back to the wretched place I came from. Have mercy upon a poor boy, sir."
"My dear child," said the old gentleman, moved by the warmth of Oliver's sudden appeal, "you need not be afraid of my deserting you, unless you give me cause."
"I never, never will, sir,"
interposed Oliver.
"I hope not," rejoined the old gentleman. "I do not think you ever will. I have been deceived before in the objects whom I have endeavoured to benefit, but I feel strongly disposed to trust you, nevertheless, and I am more interested in your behalf than I can well account for, even to myself. The persons on whom I have bestowed my dearest love lie deep in their graves, but although the happiness and delight of my life lie buried there too, I have not made a coffin of my heart and sealed it up forever on my best affections. Deep affliction has but strengthened and refined them."
As the old gentleman said this in a low voice, more to himself than to his companion, and as he remained silent for a short time afterwards, Oliver sat quite still.
"Well, well," said the old gentleman at length, in a more cheerful tone, "I only say this because you have a young heart, and knowing that I have suffered great pain and sorrow, you will be more careful, perhaps, not to wound me again. You say you are an orphan, without a friend in the world. All the inquiries I have been able to make confirm the statement. Let me hear your story, where you come from, who brought you up, and how you got into the company in which I found you. Speak the truth, and you shall not be friendless while I live." Oliver's sobs checked his utterance for some minutes. When he was on the point of beginning to relate how he had been brought up at the farm and carried to the workhouse by Mr. Bumble, a peculiarly impatient little double knock was heard at the street door, and the servant, running upstairs, announced Mr. Grimwig.
"Is he coming up?"
inquired Mr. Brownlow.
"Yes, sir," replied the servant. "He asked if there were any muffins in the house, and when I told him yes, he said he had come to tea."
Mr. Brownlow smiled, and, turning to Oliver, said that Mr. Grimwig was an old friend of his, and he must not mind his being a little rough in his manners, for he was a worthy creature at bottom, as he had reason to know.
"Shall I go downstairs, sir?" inquired Oliver.
"No," replied Mr. Brownlow. "I would rather you remained here." At this moment, there walked into the room, supporting himself by a thick stick, a stout old gentleman, rather lame in one leg, who was dressed in a blue coat, striped waistcoat, nankeen breeches and gaiters, and a broad-brimmed white hat, with the sides turned up with green. A very small plaited shirt frill stuck out from his waistcoat, and a very long steel watch chain, with nothing but a key at the end, dangled loosely below it. The ends of his white neckerchief were twisted into a ball about the size of an orange. The variety of shapes into which his countenance was twisted defied description. He had a manner of screwing his head on one side when he spoke, and of looking out of the corners of his eyes at the same time, which irresistibly reminded the beholder of a parrot. In this attitude, he fixed himself the moment he made his appearance, and, holding out a small piece of orange peel at arm's length, exclaimed, in a growling, discontented voice,
"Look here, do you see this? Isn't it a most wonderful and extraordinary thing that I can't call at a man's house, but I find a piece of this cursed poor surgeon's friend on the staircase? I've been lamed with orange peel once, and I know orange peel will be my death at last. It will, sir. Orange peel will be my death, or I'll be content to eat my own head, sir."
This was the handsome offer with which Mr. Grimwig backed and confirmed nearly every assertion he made, and it was the more singular in his case because, even admitting for the sake of argument the possibility of scientific improvements being ever brought to that pass which will enable a gentleman to eat his own head in the event of his being so disposed, Mr. Grimwig's head was such a particularly large one that the most sanguine man alive could hardly entertain a hope of being able to get through it at a sitting, to put entirely out of the question a very thick coating of powder.
"I'll eat my head, sir," repeated Mr. Grimwig, striking his stick upon the ground. "Hello, what's that?"
looking at Oliver, and retreating a pace or two.
"This is young Oliver Twist, whom we were speaking about," said Mr. Brownlow.
Oliver bowed.
"You don't mean to say that's the boy who had the fever, I hope?"
said Mr. Grimwig, recoiling a little more.
"Wait a minute, don't speak. Stop,"
continued Mr. Grimwig, abruptly losing all dread of the fever in his triumph at the discovery.
"That's the boy who had the orange. If that's not the boy, sir, who had the orange and threw this bit of peel upon the staircase, I'll eat my head and his, too."
"No, no, he has not had one," said Mr. Brownlow, laughing.
"Come, put down your hat and speak to my young friend."
"I feel strongly on this subject, sir," said the irritable old gentleman, drawing off his gloves. "There's always more or less orange peel on the pavement in our street, and I know it's put there by the surgeon's boy at the corner. A young woman stumbled over a bit last night and fell against my garden railings. Directly she got up, I saw her look towards his infernal red lamp with the pantomime light. 'Don't go to him,' I called out of the window. 'He's an assassin, a man-trap.' Or so he is. If he is not..."
Here the irascible old gentleman gave a great knock on the ground with his stick, which was always understood by his friends to imply the customary offer whenever it was not expressed in words. Then, still keeping his stick in his hand, he sat down, and opening a double eyeglass, which he wore attached to a broad black riband, took a view of Oliver, who, seeing that he was the object of inspection, coloured, and bowed again.
"That's the boy, is it?"
said Mr. Grimwig, at length.
"That is the boy," replied Mr. Brownlow.
"How are you, boy?"
said Mr. Grimwig.
"A great deal better, thank you, sir,"
replied Oliver. Mr. Brownlow, seeming to apprehend that his singular friend was about to say something disagreeable, asked Oliver to step downstairs and tell Mrs. Bedwin they were ready for tea, which, as he did not half like the visitor's manner, he was very happy to do.
"He is a nice-looking boy, is he not?" inquired Mr. Brownlow. I don't know, replied Mr. Grimwig pettishly.
Don't know?
No, I don't know. I never see any difference in boys. I only know two sorts of boys, mealy boys and beef-faced boys.
And which is Oliver?
Mealy. I know a friend who has a beef-faced boy, a fine boy they call him, with a round head and red cheeks and glaring eyes. A horrid boy, with a body and limbs that appear to be swelling out of the seams of his blue clothes, with the voice of a pilot and the appetite of a wolf. I know him, the wretch.
Come, said Mr. Brownlow. These are not the characteristics of young Oliver Twist, so he needn't excite your wrath.
They are not, replied Mr. Grimwig. He may have worse.
Here Mr. Brownlow coughed impatiently, which appeared to afford Mr. Grimwig the most exquisite delight.
He may have worse, I say, repeated Mr. Grimwig. Where does he come from? Who is he? What is he? He has had a fever. What of that? Fevers are not peculiar to good people, are they? Bad people have fevers sometimes, haven't they? Eh? I knew a man who was hung in Jamaica for murdering his master. He had had a fever 6 times. He wasn't recommended to mercy on that account. Nonsense.
Now, the fact was that in the inmost recesses of his own heart, Mr. Grimwig was strongly disposed to admit that Oliver's appearance and manner were unusually prepossessing. But he had a strong appetite for contradiction, sharpened on this occasion by the finding of the orange peel. And, inwardly determining that no man should dictate to him whether a boy was well-looking or not, he had resolved from the first to oppose his friend. When Mr. Brownlow admitted that on no one point of inquiry could he yet return a satisfactory answer, and that he had postponed any investigation into Oliver's previous history until he thought the boy was strong enough to bear it, Mr. Grimwig chuckled maliciously, and he demanded with a sneer whether the housekeeper was in the habit of counting the plate at night, because if she didn't find a tablespoon or two missing some sunshiny morning, why, he would be content to... and so forth. All this, Mr. Brownlow, although himself somewhat of an impetuous gentleman, knowing his friend's peculiarities, bore with great good humour. As Mr. Grimwig, at tea, was graciously pleased to express his entire approval of the muffins, matters went on very smoothly, and Oliver, who made one of the party, began to feel more at his ease than he had yet done in the fierce old gentleman's presence.
"And when are you going to hear a full, true, and particular account of the life and adventures of Oliver Twist?"
asked Grimwig of Mr. Brownlow at the conclusion of the meal, looking sideways at Oliver as he resumed the subject.
"Tomorrow morning," replied Mr. Brownlow. "I would rather he was alone with me at the time. Come up to me tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, my dear."
"Yes, sir," replied Oliver.
He answered with some hesitation, because he was confused by Mr. Grimwig's looking so hard at him.
"I'll tell you what," whispered that gentleman to Mr. Brownlow. "He won't come up to you tomorrow morning. I saw him hesitate. He is deceiving you, my good friend." "I'll swear he is not," replied Mr. Brownlow warmly. "If he is not," said Mr. Grimwig, "I'll—" and down went the stick. "I'll answer for that boy's truth with my life," said Mr. Brownlow, knocking the table. "And I for his falsehood with my head," rejoined Mr. Grimwig, knocking the table also. "We shall see," said Mr. Brownlow, checking his rising anger.
"We will," replied Mr. Grimwig with a provoking smile. "We will."
As fate would have it, Mrs. Bedwin chanced to bring in, at this moment, a small parcel of books, which Mr. Brownlow had that morning purchased of the identical bookstall keeper who has already figured in this history. Having laid them on the table, she prepared to leave the room.
"Stop the boy, Mrs. Bedwin," said Mr. Brownlow. "There is something to go back."
"He is gone, sir," replied Mrs. Bedwin.
"Well, call after him," said Mr. Brownlow. "It's particular. He is a poor man, and they're not paid for. There are some books to be taken back, too."
The street door was opened. Oliver ran one way, and the girl ran another, and Mrs. Bedwin stood on the step and screamed for the boy, but there was no boy in sight. Oliver and the girl returned in a breathless state to report that there were no tidings of him.
"Dear me, I'm very sorry for that," exclaimed Mr. Brownlow. "I particularly wished those books to be returned tonight."
"Send Oliver with them," said Mr. Grimwig, with an ironical smile. "He will be sure to deliver them safely, you know."
"Yes. Do let me take them, if you please, sir," said Oliver. "I'll run all the way, sir."
The old gentleman was just going to say that Oliver should not go out on any account when a most malicious cough from Mr. Grimwig determined him that he should, and that by his prompt discharge of the commission he should prove to him the injustice of his suspicions, on this head at least, at once.
"You shall go, my dear," said the old gentleman. "The books are on a chair by my table. Fetch them down."
Oliver, delighted to be of use, brought down the books under his arm in a great bustle, and waited, cap in hand, to hear